whatever befall, still be my vision, O ruler of all. Whatever befall us, we know that we have a good ruler and a good guide in Jesus, himself being the very wisdom of God. In the past few weeks have reminded us of the transient nature of life. In many cases, what once seemed unshakable proved unstable. And though such instability stirs up anxiety, we understand that as the people of God, that all things must run their course, with the end that even heaven and earth themselves manifest instability. And John in Revelation 21:1 says, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. At the end of the age, nothing will remain standing. No king or kingdom, no earthly nation or civilization, not a single one. Within this framework, nothing exists securely. No job, no investment, no pursuit upholds under extensive instability. However, in the midst of such exhaustive instability, something eternally stable emerges. A king and his kingdom occupying a new heaven and a new earth, but this without a sea." Now, this does not mean that bodies of water will not exist on the new earth, but rather that chaos and destruction will not remain. Going back to ancient days, the sea embodied chaos and destruction. The psalmists and the prophets believed that the Lord to be the only one who could calm the chaos of the sea, the raging of the sea. This theme prevails throughout the prophets and the Psalms. Almost every prophet keys in on this theme. We saw it, maybe it was last week, I don't remember now, but Habakkuk 3, verse 8, "Was your wrath against the rivers, O Lord? Was your anger against the rivers, or your indignation against the sea? When you rode on your horses, on your chariot of salvation," this imagery of God coming for salvation of his people, saving them from the sea, the raging of the sea. And Zechariah speaking of the redeemed who were going to return to their land to dwell with God, says, chapter 10, verse 11, "He shall pass," the one who returns, "shall pass through the sea of troubles and strike down the waves of the sea." The sea was this chaos that stood in the way of these returning people. And so, of course, God, Elohim, the God of gods, is the one, as the psalmist says, Psalm 65, 7, "who stills the roaring of the seas, the roaring of their waves, the tumult of the peoples." So it's not as though God is actually going to war against the waves of the Pacific Ocean or some such thing. The chaos is the very tumult of the people, the uprising of the people against all that is good. And so when Jesus calms the storm, Matthew 8, 27, "And the men marveled, saying, what sort of man is this, that even the winds and the sea obey him?" The disciples understand that Jesus is not just merely exhibiting power over creation, but the very power of the I am to calm the raging of the sea. And when we come to Revelation, this great dragon of chapter 12, this dragon who makes war against Israel, who makes war against Israel's male child, the Messiah, and who makes war against all who hold to the testimony of Jesus, Revelation 12, 17 says, "He stood on the sand of the sea." He stood awaiting to see what would arise out of this chaos. And of course, what arises out of the chaos? The beast. The beast, Revelation 13, 1, the beast comes rising out of the sea. And John is not predicting some sort of Godzilla or monster that's going to emerge from the ocean covered with seaweed, but a man who rises from chaos, from violence, from evil. This chaos shaped by the sin of man and the deceit of Satan. And this beast is pictured as looking like a shepherd and a lion, a leopard and a lion and a bear with 10 horns. It seems strange, but if you go to Daniel chapter 7, Daniel prophesied about 4 beasts arising. One like a shepherd, like a leopard, one like a lion, one like a bear, and one with 10 horns. And of course, these were kings of nations that were going to rise up and exhibit some sort of dominion over the earth and try to install some form of emperor worship in exaltation over everything else. And we see that in the kingdoms of Babylon and then Persia and then the Greeks and then the Romans. Those are the 10 kingdoms. We see, of course, in Babylon, the kingdom of Daniel's day, and Nebuchadnezzar makes this monstrous statue for which the people were to bow down and worship Nebuchadnezzar as the Most High. Of course, that gets Daniel thrown into the lion's den. But we see it in Persia. Persia is the kingdom that overthrew the Babylonians, and they're the ones who were in power in the day of Esther. And then you have the Greeks overthrow the Persians. And the Greeks, one of their rulers was a man by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes. He took the name Epiphanes once he became a ruler. And Epiphanes generally means the brilliant one, the shining one. But it also came to mean God manifest. God manifest. Here is God. That's the name he took for himself. And he was the man who in 168, 167 BC marched into Jerusalem, struck down thousands of worshipers at the temple, installed a altar to Zeus, and then offered pigs on that altar, this ultimate blasphemy against God and his people. And then, of course, we come to the Romans who overthrew the Greeks in 67 BC with Pompey. And the Romans installed a form of emperor worship, the Caesar, of course, Caesar Augustus, Julius Caesar, where we get our months July and August from. Augustus means most revered, and they referred to the Caesar as our Lord and God. So at the end of the Gospel of John, when John says to Jesus, my Lord and God, it's a direct refutation of this emperor worship. Anyways, this beast that comes out of the sea, he's a composite of all these kings and these nations who's coming to install a worship to himself over and against God and everything that God stands for. But who carries the power to calm the sea? Right? Who carries the power to institute a new heaven and a new earth without a sea? That's the king we serve. His kingdom will be stable, will be sure. Not even the most powerful king or nation ever to rise from the kings of the earth will stand in the way of the King of Kings to do what he pleases. And so those who hold to testimony of Jesus inherit a kingdom established on the new heaven and the new earth, imperishable, stable, unaffected by chaos, unaffected by evil and this destruction of the sea. Just the combined tumult of the people to rise against God and his people. And the chaos and the destruction caused by COVID-19 and all associated responses will not find a place in that kingdom. And this is good news. This is the kingdom that we live in, that we proclaim. And we live now as though that's the kingdom we inherit, as though that's the king we serve. And even as we might intellectually understand the notion of such biblical renewal, this new heaven, this new earth without a sea, wisely living out our days in an ephemeral world, a fleeting, temporary world, proves challenging since our hearts desire stability, dependability, cohesion, and it's difficult to keep our lives oriented on the eternal when what's before us seems so pressing. The very disciples of Jesus struggled themselves to understand the course of the world, to keep their minds fixed on the eternal. They often put too much stock into the supposed unshakable nature of this present world. The week before the death of Jesus, the disciples gazed in awe upon the temple building. In Matthew 24, verse 1, it says, Jesus left the temple and was going away when his disciples came to point out to him the buildings of the temple. Now, Mark and Luke make clear that the disciples are not just merely pointing out the temple, that Jesus just came from the temple. Jesus is sort of familiar with the temple. It's not as though they're just saying, hey, Jesus, check that out. Cool building, huh? Right? They were gushing with this preoccupied wonder at the physical beauty of the temple. And the world at that time considered this temple to be a, if not the great architectural wonder of the world. And even though the temple had been destroyed previously, 600 years earlier, Jewish apocalyptic thought at the time believed that this temple to be indestructible. It would stand till the end of time. But even the temple, this pinnacle of divine worship, would prove to be just as unstable as the rest of creation. And Jesus, in verses 2 and 3, he answered them, you see all these, do you not? Truly I say to you, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down. As he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? And for the disciples, the destruction of the temple can only mean one thing, the end of the age. As goes the temple, so goes the world. If this indestructible masterpiece of humanity were to be destroyed, then it might as well just be the end of the world. The preoccupation with the end times, the end of the world, is not a new phenomenon. Upon hearing the impossible, that this temple would be destroyed, so the disciples seek out Jesus, to hear from Jesus all the details, the exact details of how this would come about and what would be happening. All these details surrounding the end. But Jesus, rather than exhibit a preoccupation with the end times, reveals rather a pressing concern for how the disciples will live in such a day, regardless of what come to pass. And in verses 4 through 8, Jesus answered them, see that no one leads you astray. For many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ. And they will lead many astray. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not alarmed, for this must take place. But the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and earthquakes in various places. And all these are but the beginning of birth pains. Yeah, for some out there, every war or rumor of war, every earthquake, every famine, every sign in the heavens portent the end times. For Jesus, these were just merely assured events that marked the beginning of birth pains. These are just things that Jesus said, hey, these, don't be alarmed. These must take place. This is what's going to happen. These are the beginning of birth pains. And you know that the beginning of birth pains mark this period of expectancy. Once the birth pains come, you know the baby is on its way. However, in the midst of that birth pain period, no one still knows the exact timing, other than perhaps one more contraction means just a little while longer. And for all we know, according to God's reckoning of time, as Moses says, 1,000 years is but a day, God's conception of time is not like ours. The day of new birth, of renewal, of the new heaven, the new earth, maybe 1,000 years off. Be that as it may, Habakkuk says, the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It surely will come. It will not delay. He was not talking about the end, but of course the destruction of Israel at the hand of the Babylonians. But yet, the same applies. The day approaches. It will not delay, and yet we know not the day of its coming. As such, knowing the certainty of the end, that Jesus, instead of affirming the disciples' concerns, answering all the details of their questions, Jesus rather shows a concern that the coming events might cause the disciples to deviate from their purpose, even to be led astray, and start ringing alarm bells. And Jesus' concerns, I think we can fairly say, we're not misguided. And Jesus, in addition, shows concerns that the disciples will be tempted toward apostasy and apathy at the hand of the circumstances experienced during this birth period. And he says in verses 9 through 12, "Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and put you to death, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will fall away and betray one another and hate one another. And many false prophets will arise and lead many astray. And because lawlessness will be increased, the love of many will grow cold." So as this day of new birth draws near, as these birth pangs continue to give contractions, they produce a growing persecution against Christians who will be hated among every nation. There's no nation that will not have people that hate Christians. And even maybe the nation itself. In addition, false prophets arise, people who deny the name of Jesus and speak purely for personal gain. False prophets aren't people who merely have a contrary view of some particular doctrine, but those who speak contrary to the very person and work of Jesus out of a self-indulgent greed and purely fleshly, carnal, physical view of the world. Jude speaks of false prophets, and Jude is almost the same as 2 Peter chapter 2. But speaking of these false prophets, Jude says, "They're the ones relying on their dreams, defiling the flesh, rejecting authority, and blaspheme the glorious ones," presumably angels. "And these people blaspheme all that they do not understand. They, like unreasoning animals, understand instinctively." They just use instinct as the basis for how they understand the world and how they live within the world. "As they feast with you without fear," of course, one of the primary marks of a Christian is to fear the Lord. "Shepherds feeding themselves, these are grumblers." I just love, they have no contentment. They are grumblers, malcontents, following their own sinful desires. They are loudmouth boasters, showing favoritism to gain advantage. "Without regard to the Messiah, who forgives sin and thus decreases lawlessness." Right? Forgiven sins decreases lawlessness, because forgiven sins means righteousness. Righteousness is the contrast to lawlessness. These false prophets produce a lawlessness counter the gospel, because they reject the gospel. They reject God's authority to compel righteous living according to the forgiveness of sins. And in the midst of this increased persecution and increased lawlessness that's especially spurred on by false prophets, many people fall away and allow their love for God and for others to grow cold. And perhaps those who fall away considered persecution to be too costly, not worth the time, not worth the pain, not worth the suffering, or the increased lawlessness as too frustrating. Regardless of their particular reasons, presumably these who fall away exchanged a spiritual view of the world for a purely carnal, physical view of the world. They only see the world from a fleshly, worldly, physical perspective. There's no spiritual world around us and among us. Of course, you deny the spiritual, you deny the forgiveness of sins, you deny the resurrection, you deny the ascension, you deny all these things. Their minds and hearts have been replaced, and of course, these spiritual concepts of Jesus as the living water, Jesus as the bread of life, if that were a physical concept, that would be really strange. If that were a purely physical concept, right? If Jesus were the living water, if that were purely physical, we'd be drinking his saliva or something. So that has to be a spiritual concept. So these people have denied the spiritual realm, the spiritual nature of things, have traded partaking in Jesus as the living water, as the bread of life, and have merely interacted with the world from a fleshly, physical, carnal perspective, in whatever manner really seemed reasonable to them. Some of these things, well, new birth doesn't seem reasonable. And so we have need of endurance and perseverance. And Jesus says in verse 13 of Matthew 24, the one who endures to the end will be saved. Paul, seeing the necessity himself of this endurance, prayed for the Colossians to be, I don't have this verse up there, but he prayed for them to be strengthened with power according to the glorious might of God for all perseverance and patience with joy. It's chapter 1, verse 11. And John, in Revelation 14, 12, I don't have this one up there either, but John, exhorting the saints who are experiencing the suffering under this temporary dominion of the dragon and the beast, said, here is the call for the endurance of the saints, those who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. The times call for endurance, continuing in the righteousness and faithfulness of Jesus. And not only that, but continuing in the mission of Jesus. Jesus closes this part of his dialogue in verse 14. He says, and this gospel of the kingdom, the good news of the kingdom, this stable, steadfast kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. Jesus gives a clarion call to proclaim the gospel of the kingdom, a kingdom without end, to the whole world as a testimony of Jesus to every nation, that every nation would hear. And so the return of the king, I think, awaits nothing more than the preaching of the gospel to the ends of the earth. Peter concludes that any perceived delay in the Messiah's return happens only for the sake of the redeemed, that all should reach repentance. That's what the delay is all about. Jesus waiting for the fullness of the saints who will turn and fill this renewed heaven and earth. If there's any delay, it's for the sake of salvation. And so we eagerly await the return of the King. We eagerly look forward to that day. We yearn for, sometimes even with tears, but we wait in faith and patience, in faithful endurance, knowing the purpose of any perceived delay. Of course, there's no delay on God's part. And every generation since Paul, remember Paul in some of his letters, he's already dealing with churches who either have thought the return happened or are expecting the return in their day. John, Revelation, his churches are expecting the return of Jesus. Every generation since Paul expect the return of Jesus. And so, surely the end is near. No doubt. And yet, God's accounting of time means perhaps just a little while longer. Until the birth pangs yield the new heaven and the new earth and the fulfillment of God's kingdom. And just a little while longer already yielded 2,000 years. So we ought to be careful in our accounting of time. Suppose it could be tomorrow or the next day or what have you. That doesn't seem to be the concern of Jesus nor any of the apostles of the early church. Their concern was with how the Christians would live out their days in faithfulness. And so we ought to give consideration to Jesus' exhortation that his disciples would live righteously now, bearing up under any persecution and lawlessness and bringing the testimony of Jesus to every nation. That's the call. That's the responsibility. That's the faithfulness. In Hebrews 12, the apostle writing to a church under affliction, under great affliction, it said their property, their homes had been seized. And interestingly enough, it says that they allowed their property to be seized joyfully. But they were under great affliction, being imprisoned. Their property was being seized because of their claim to Jesus. He's giving them encouragement here at the end of Hebrews chapter 12. And he says, at that time his voice shook the earth, but now he has promised, yet once more I will shake not only the earth, but also the heavens. Of course, that's why there's a new heaven and new earth. says this phrase, yet once more, indicates the removal of things that are shaken. That is, things that have been made in order that the things that cannot be shaken may remain. Whatever happens, whatever the earth comes to its end is good. Whatever cataclysm comes upon us is good. Because God is shaking out everything that can be shaken in order that only what is eternal may remain. But then, of course, his application, verse 28. Therefore, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, and thus let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. So he writes, here's the conclusion. Whatever is going on, here's the responsibility. Offer to God acceptable worship while exhibiting gratefulness, reverence, awe, or godly fear. And the word worship is a reasonable translation of the Greek word latruo there. But some have minimized this, the concept of worship, so that worship merely means the singing of songs or even the Sunday morning service. And surely those are elements of worship. But worship, the word worship, the Greek word latruo, where we get the word worship, means service. It just means a life of service to God. Worship is just living your life to God in every godly way that he has laid out. Our whole lives lived in worship to God. We sing songs of worship. We participate in this unique form of worship on a Sunday morning, Sunday morning service of worship, I call it. That's just to spur us on to a life of worship throughout the week. And since we have received a kingdom which cannot be shaken, unlike every single temporal kingdom, we must render appropriate service to God. You go through Hebrews chapter 13 to see what the apostle thinks is an appropriate service of worship. He starts out by saying, let the brotherly love continue. According to Jesus in Matthew 24, I think he offers three primary points of concern to his disciples, three primary points of what I would call worship, a life of worship. Fervent love, faithful endurance, and flourishing testimony. Jesus' concern was that they would continue in love, that they would continue in faithfulness to the things of God, the righteousness, the commandments of God, and that they would carry the gospel to the ends of the earth. So if we get anything right, it's that we ought to love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength. Love one another as ourselves. Love our neighbor. Continue in faithful godliness, not lawlessness, but godliness, righteousness. Every behavior pleasing to God, and carry out faithful testimony to the gospel of the kingdom of Jesus. The good news that through the cross, Jesus paid the price to redeem us from slavery to sin, reconcile us to God. But not just that we would have a relationship with God, but that we would be citizens of this kingdom, ruled over by this king, and even serve as co-regents with him. We see that phrase several times, that we will reign with him. We will reign with him, exhibiting dominion over this new heaven and this new earth, combined as one, as the very dwelling place of God with his people. You go to Revelation, the end of Revelation, you see all this reference to people, the nations living in this new earth, carrying out business, living a life, just living life to its full in perfection in a place without a sea. Of course, as Paul says, and anyone who calls upon the name of the Lord will be saved. I think about all the work you have to do to invest, to reap the rewards of investment. I mean, if you want to, of course, you could sacrifice some money if your employer has a 401k account or some IRA or some such thing. But we don't see the work that they do, but they're constantly paying attention to the markets and trying to buy and sell at the right times and trade between different funds. There's a lot of work that goes into merely trying to gain a few earthly dollars that will pass away at some point. And as we've seen here, your investment is really not all that secure in the end. But all that work to just gain something that's fleeting and will be gone at some point. And yet here to us is offered all the inheritance of God. And everything that God could conceive of, however God conceives of things, however God creates things, and all his creative perfection and all his glory, whatever God could offer as an inheritance, he offers it to anyone who calls upon the name of the Lord, who claims the name of Jesus, and in that name endures faithful to the end. That's grace. That's grace. And that's the God we serve. That's the God we worship. That's the God that we, as the people of God, our primary task is living for him and giving witness to the world around us. We cannot be distracted from that mission. And there are so many things that will distract you. And Jesus was concerned that his disciples would be distracted. Thankfully, in the end, they got it right. We read their stories through Acts. And he exhibits that same concern over the church, that we would be distracted. We would fail to carry out the primary directives given. The word gives us the good way, so let us walk in it.